Hello, kings and queens of your own story realms, claimers of your family narratives, and sage observers of dynamics mundane and complex. I'm Brooke Warner, one half of the Right Minded team, and lucky for me and for all of you, my other half is here. Hey, Grant.
Yeah, I'm here. Hey, Brooke.
He's actually here.
Yeah.
Today, we're going to be talking about family stories and writing the family story. And it's probably the number one thing most writers write about, actually, whether they set out to do it or not. When you're a memoirist, it's actually pretty tough to avoid the family of origin. And in that way, I think that writing memoir is always a bit like therapy and that it all comes back to mom and dad. And I suppose there's no way of escaping the roles our families play in sharing our experience of the world. So Grant, I'm curious, what is your favorite novel that centers on family?
It's funny because I've been thinking of family kind of since we interviewed Jamie Attenberg a year or two ago, and I thought about how her novels tend to always be centered around a family. And although I personally think of my family a lot in my personal life, I almost never write about family dynamics in my fiction. In fact, families are always kind of orbiting around a character's actions rather than being the place of the drama. And I think this applies to my reading life as well, which I just realized. I like stories based on solo characters who are adrift or separate from their families and searching for themselves. But to answer your question, I thought, maybe a couple somewhat different family dramas that deal with the main character being estranged or separate from the family unit. I'm thinking of Ocean Vuong's On Earth Were Briefly Gorgeous, which I read recently and I'm enamored by. And it takes the form of a son writing a letter to his mother to explain his life to her and to explain it to himself. But it's a letter written in English, which she can't read. She's Vietnamese. And he's largely telling her about a life here in the United States that she also might not be able to completely understand. So it's a novel in part about that overwhelming need to be one with your family, but being inherently separate and kind of on your own in your own language. And I suppose that could be said to be the theme of Kafka's The Metamorphosis as well. I recently reread that. And if you don't know the story, the main character, Gregor Samsa, wakes up one morning to find himself inexplicably transformed into a huge insect. And I'd actually forgotten the family's role in the story, but they initially at least try to understand and care for him for a period of time, as much as they're kind of revolted by his presence. And his sister Greta supplies him with food, and they try to arrange the apartment so that he can better move in this new state. But of course, they quickly end up mistreating him and being cruel, and they're burdened by him, burdened by the care of him, and they start to resent his presence. And in the end, their lack of love and their self-interest essentially kills him. So it's a depressing story of family relations in the end, which I'm just going to say, the moral is don't turn into a cockroach. So of any form, you know.
High-level takeaway.
So how about you, Brooke? What family novels come to mind?
Yeah, a lot come to mind. I mean, whenever we talk about books in this way, I always think of ones that I read a long time ago, like Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections and Jeffrey Eugenides' Middlesex and Sue Miller's The Good Mother, all of which made major impressions on me, you know, when I was younger, but not too young. I mean, I think I read those books like in my late 20s and early 30s. But I'll speak to a book that I read over the holiday break, so just very recently, which was Curtis Sittenfeld's Rodham, mm-hmm. which is speculative fiction about what would have happened if Hillary hadn't married Bill Clinton. So, of course, it's fiction, but Sittenfeld dedicates a lot of space to Hillary's influences, which included her very supportive mother and her sometimes very nasty father. And I realized that I didn't know how much of that was true, although I expect that the author, I know she did because I read the acknowledgments, drew from Hillary's personal experiences. But it was a really interesting exercise in considering family dynamics in light of an alternate history. And it made me think about the responsibility that novelists have to get the dynamics right. And since it lingered with me, Sittenfeld clearly did something right because she made me think and consider both Hillary's alternate life and the choices that she made and the choices that I've made, you know, where mm-hmm. I might have had a different outcome, but also at the core that our parental influences are so central to who we become, whether we live out a life, you know, sort of in reaction to our parents. Well, frankly, I mean, living a life in reaction to our parents is unavoidable in some ways.
Yeah. I imagine if you did a study of novels that have been written in the last 100 years or so, you could categorize so many of them according to how characters are determined by their parents or estranged from their parents in a way that wouldn't have been the case in a previous 100 years. And I say this because there have been, you know, there's such a heightened attunement to a person's relation to their family because of the advent of psychology and Freud and child development, things like that. And, you know, I was recently thinking about the Tolstoy quote that, he says every story is about either about a person coming to a town or leaving a town. And I think you could replace town with family and say every story is about a person's way of being in a family or leaving a family. So just as you can say that, you know, I like to say that every story is somehow a love story or an adventure story. I think you can also say every story is also a family story. You know, even my story is about supposedly lone wolves because they are, they're motivated by flight from their families. So they have a reaction to their families. And Will Cather said, most of the basic material a writer works with is acquired before the age of 15. And I think this is what she was talking about. I've always wondered what she really meant by that quote. But I think that's it, is that our life and our families determines our stories.
Yeah, they sure do. And certainly that is the case for today's guest, Louis Chude Soki, who delves into these questions head on in his memoir, which is called Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. And it's about exile and loss. His mother actually fled the subsumed nation of Biafra when he was just a baby, which is now part of Nigeria. And part of what he's unpacking in his story is these family dynamics. You know, his father who was killed, the country he was born into being subsumed, led his mother to flee. And then he deals with these relationships that he has, you know, particularly the relationship that he has with his mother. So there's the father-son relationship, the mother-son relationship, the father he never knew, the mother who struggled to make a life for herself and her son in the States. And so it's different from the life she imagined for herself, of course, when she married Lewis's father and moved to Africa. And it's just this incredibly unique family story. And yet I kept coming back to the ways in which it was so universal with the twists and turns and how all lives have those twists and turns that lead us to be, you know, here where we are in the present.
Yeah, I was really struck by the tenderness that Lewis has for his young self, a kind of care that's taken to show the reader how the ways that he didn't know any better. And much of the book is about him trying to make sense of his life, of his experience, and of his longings. And he doesn't have a dad or much male influence. He's almost entirely surrounded by women. And it's interesting to me because this reminded me of The Tender Bar, a memoir by J.R. Moringer, who also lost his father and was searching for male guidance, even though his mother was very much at the center, a powerful center of his world. And he found that father in a chorus of men's voices at a bar down the street from his home. And it's interesting because of the things we've talked about in regard to family, that bar and the men in it, you know, became his father in a way, his center, his sanctuary, and it forms both something to find himself in and react against. And for Lewis, he finds that center in Black culture. And in both cases, the bar for JR and Black culture for Lewis, there are things that are both really wonderful and really toxic. And both authors are showing how we create families, even in the absence of a family.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, when I was reading Lewis's book, I was thinking, you know, this is the kind of story that if you have this life, other people are constantly telling you, you must write a book, you know, especially a memoir. And a lot of people, probably our listeners too, may have gotten that kind of feedback. You know, maybe you've had a miraculous life or a rarefied life, or you've survived something incredible. And, you know, Lewis certainly had those kinds of experiences, which are extraordinary in certain ways. But not everybody has stories so extreme as his. And plenty of family memoirs are compelling simply because one or both parents are eccentric or because of the religious experience. You know, I've read a lot of memoirs about people who grew up in cults, for instance, you know, or because there are tons of kids, like lots of times in these Catholic families that I've worked on lots of memoirs about the oldest sibling from a Catholic family, or because of just some other experience, like having a gay parent or being adopted or suffering abuse. And there are just so many stories to tell, family stories. And I feel like we're better off for getting a window into these experiences. And it just makes me think again about how much reading makes us more compassionate and global citizens.
Yeah, I'm on that note, I'm going to quote Tolstoy one more time. This is an episode with two Tolstoy quotes. Count them. He wrote in Anna Karenina, "Happy families are all alike." This is a famous quote. "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." And yeah, that's why we write and read, to understand the weird complexity of it all and how we fit into it, and to relate to others and feel, you know, both unique and a part of something beyond ourselves. And I think that's why I'm fascinated by a different kind of family as well, which is place, and why I write a fair amount about where I was born, Iowa. And I'm trying to understand how I fit and didn't fit and why. And right now I'm just thinking maybe I should write a letter to a place similar to Ocean Vuong's letter to his mother.
Oh, gosh, I love the idea, Grant, and I hope you will experiment with that. You always come up with great ideas mid-episode in that way.
Thank you. Maybe I will.
Yeah, let me know. And I can't wait to hear what Lewis has to say about writing the family story, something we know many of you are doing or may want to do someday. So we will be right back with you after this short break.
So, Brooke, on last week's episode, we shared with our listeners that DIY MFA founder Gabriela Pereira was launching a video series and webinar that we hoped they'd tune into. Those webinars are happening this week, and depending on when you're listening to this show, they might be in the rearview mirror. But the good news is that there's more, and we want to share with you what Gabriela has in store.
That's right, because the free webinar, which you can definitely still access at DIYMFA.com, was a build-up to a more important offering, which is enrollment for Gabriela's flagship course, DIY MFA 101. And this is a 10-week course that will teach you how to write with focus, read with purpose, and build your community.
Yeah, Brooke, you know, I know that writers love DIY MFA. In fact, I've heard this from NaNoWriMo writers. And it really is a good alternative to the expensive MFAs and can be very helpful, but without spending a lot of money and leaving you wanting more opportunities to write, read, and be in community with other writers. And you get all that when you enroll in DIY MFA 101. So, Brooke, this is your turn to share our special URL this week.
Yes, and thank you. You can learn more and enroll at DIYMFA.com/write-minded-enroll. I'll say it one more time, DIYMFA.com/write-minded-enroll. Note that enrollment closes this week on Friday, March 5th at midnight Eastern. So go check it out. We're big fans of DIY MFA and all the good work Gabriela and her team are doing. We are back with today's guest, Lewis Chude Soki, and his writing and award-winning scholarship is on the literatures and cultures of the African diaspora, and they appear widely in international and national venues. He's the editor-in-chief of The Black Scholar, the premier journal of Black studies and research, and director of the African American Studies program at Boston University. And right now, he's here with us. Hi, Lewis. It's so wonderful to have you on Right Minded.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so I'd like to start by asking you about the journey to write your memoir. It's pretty epic, and we're going to get into it a little bit more. But when did you have a sense that you might want to tell this story, and how long did it take to come to fruition?
Well, I should probably start by being honest about the fact that I spent more of my time avoiding telling the story than anything else. Not only because I thought, oh, I'm too young to write a memoir, because I've been thinking about this for many years, but it just seemed overwhelming to me because I had so many stories. There's my mother's story, which is quite epic, as you put it. There's my father's story, the Nigerian aspect, the Jamaican aspect, and then my experience in America. All of those things just seemed overwhelming. So I spent a lot of years not wanting to write the memoir, even though my mother always knew that it should be a story that's told by me. I think it began to crystallize into one book probably around 1999 or so, because I remember standing in line at a concert and someone asked me, what are you writing? And I described, strangely enough, the book that I just wrote. Although between then and now, it's been through so many different forms, because you know, there's the academic career and writing scholarly work, but then there's also just balancing, as I said, multiple epic stories. And it wasn't clear to me that it could all fit in one book. So it really started to become a real thing, though, in the wake of my mother's death in 2005, because at that point I felt that I'd gotten older, but I'd failed because she really wanted me to tell the story and I was still putting it off. And after she passed away, it seemed necessary to just give up everything and focus on it. That, of course, led to even more struggles with the book. And then my godfather, who was the head of state of Biafra, then he died. And I realized the two people who are the pillars of this narrative have died and they'll never hear the story. And that really lit a fire under me to really turn it into something.
Wow, that is quite a story of a work. And your father was quite famous in your native Biafra, which was a nation that existed for all of 3 years and is what's known as a subsumed state, just for our listeners to know. And your godfather was the original president of that country, and you had a sense from early on of your unique importance and of your father's legacy. And yet so much of your book is about this complexity of identity you experience, you know, being your father's son, the first son of Biafra, of being raised in Jamaica, of being American and longing to fit into Black American culture. And I feel like the way you write about identity is both so singular and also common in America, where we are, you know, a melting pot of cultures and where there are a lot of people like you who are immigrants and children of multiple nations and also just striving to be like everyone else when they're young.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm curious, how aware were you while writing the book of balancing the uniqueness of your experience with the universality of your experience?
That's probably why it was important for me to spend so much time avoiding the story. and by that, I mean, the American narrative is the immigrant narrative, right? I mean, it's so crucial to American literature and American culture. And it's sometimes hard to be unique because it's such an established narrative form in the United States. But at the same time, I realized that the experience of Black immigrants to an America that professes to be open, but is actually quite limited in terms of how it understands race and your place in it, I wasn't sure how to tell that story because there's not a lot of language for that. You know, there's not a lot of narratives that allow the sort of internal tensions of race within Blackness. But because I'm a scholar and I've studied race in America and race globally, I also knew that that was a very painful narrative. And to find a way to tell it that is honest about the difficulty, but not put people off because it is such a taboo topic, that was a part of, again, my long hesitation in trying to tell that story.
You did a really profoundly good job of it, Lewis. I just, my mind was kind of like, oh, wow, I never thought about so much of this stuff before. But your memoir, of course, has a lot of themes. And one certainly is about family and family legacy. And in your case, you had the father you never knew, the legacy of this short-lived country, and your mother's resilience, and also her stature in the diaspora, and all of the many things that you didn't know about her and your history. Like you said, you didn't know until she was dying, and you finally have the chance to ask her a lot of questions and to reconcile some things. This was so significant, and I wonder if you ever thought about how this book would have been different if you hadn't had the chance to get some of those stories from her.
I think that's also something, to go back to an earlier question, it's getting some of that information from her only when she knew she was dying that enabled me to put together a whole story, right? The previous question also asked about my awareness of the uniqueness of the story. The awareness that I had of the uniqueness of the story was not just because I've studied race and I know how immigration works in America, was because of my mom. Right? It's a very unique story, a Jamaican woman migrating from colonial Jamaica to post-war England and meeting an African. And a few weeks later, she's in Nigeria on the eve of genocide. Mm-hmm. Right. And so she knew that it was a unique story. So trying to tell the uniqueness of that story against the larger historical and metaphorical, meanings of the Black diaspora and migration was a real challenge. But I'm glad you think that it was pulled off, because I did that for my mother.
Well, you know, speaking of doing that for your mother, so many people want to write their family stories. And, you know, family stories can be challenging to write for any number of reasons. Now that you're on the other side of the publication of Floating in a Most Peculiar Way.
Almost on the other side.
Oh, okay. Almost on the other side. You're on the other side of writing it, I guess. So to go back to the writing of it, you know, what advice do you have for people on how to capture their family stories?
Wow, that's really interesting. The reason I say that I'm still not sure I'm on the other side of it is that having conversations like this this is when I'm now realizing, oh, you actually finished it.
We read it.
Exactly, because it's been in my head, and even though it's out and, you know, folks like you have copies and you've read it, in my head it's still me and my editor. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's hard to think of advice. I guess the only practical advice I could give, and well, I'm sure I could say more than this, but the first thing that comes to mind is you kind of have to let it. This is so cliche, and I really hate cliches, which is what took me so long writing this book. But you kind of have to let it tell itself. I mean, you have to wait. Mm-hmm. I feel like I had to wait a really long time to be able to do justice to all of the family stories, all of the people in the story, and all of the different experiences, right? You can't actually rush it, which is why I think it's good that I wrote so many other things and in other languages and, I mean, other types of language, academic and political and public. It was good that I did all of that while waiting for the story to take shape and while waiting to assemble the bits of information that I got from my mother you know, the other bits of information that I found when I started reading my godfather's memoirs and things like that, and traveling to Nigeria and talking to people. I didn't rush the story. And that was good, because it started out with me avoiding writing it. But then once I realized I had to write it, I didn't rush trying to get it written. And that would be advice. As a writer, you want to get something done. Well, I would say, while waiting for this, do some other stuff.
Right. Well, as I said, Lewis, I was struck by how you write about Blackness in America, and I wanted to focus in on this one scene. In high school, you had this gym teacher who knew that you were a bit of a book nerd, and so she's able to walk this line between encouraging you to read while also not outing you to your friends as being a book nerd so that you could maintain a certain status among your friends.
Yes.
And while I was reading that, I found myself feeling a little sad at the way that you wrote that. And of course, we only see it through the vantage point of your teen self. But my question is what your thoughts are on this as an adult, you know, this role of books as uncool, especially for certain kinds of kids who value their street cred. And is that particularly American, and is it particularly a problem for that matter?
I want to emphasize, though, it wasn't just being a book nerd. It was being a science fiction book nerd. That's right. Even worse.
Specifically.
Right. And we're talking in the 70s, too. It wasn't cool back then. Right. I try to make a contrast, though. Earlier than that scene, where even though in Jamaica, growing up in Jamaica, books were hard to come by. Right. But also a sign of privilege. You showed them on your shelves, but no one actually read them. In the house that I grew up in, books were seen as a thing that were worthy of your respect. If a kid read books, people respected that. And so even as a very young kid, I was called upon to help, you know, the local people learn to read. And I remember that very distinctly, being very young, but showing people what these words meant and et cetera, et cetera. Coming to America, at least specifically coming to Los Angeles, in that area in LA, books were a sign of weakness and vulnerability, right? And I didn't know that, but I learned it the hard way, because I arrived thinking books make me cooler than everyone else, because in Jamaica they did. But here it was the opposite, right? Books meant that you were white or that you were weak or that you were gay or things like that. And I want to specify, though, that the books being a signifier of whiteness, right? As I say in the book, it didn't seem to be about whiteness per se, because the white people didn't read books either. It didn't seem to me that white people were all sitting around reading books and were like having deep intellectual conversations. Nobody was, black or white. So it seemed then to me that books seemed to signify something entirely different. And as a kid, I didn't know what that was. And so I only could conclude that books made you act differently. Books made you think differently or speak differently. And that allowed you to be judged by your community as being unwilling to fit within it. And so that's how I concluded in that period of time how books functioned for the community I was in. And one of the things that was so important about that teacher, the coach, right, was that coach understood that street credibility, young black masculinity in that particular neighborhood was important to maintain. And I think there's a section where I say, the fact that she continued to treat me like a thug in public was remarkably generous.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Interesting.
And that's exactly how it felt, right? That she understood that I needed to keep that aspect of my life private. But then that led to a lifetime of many years of keeping it very private, not being sure that I could share it with anyone around me. And so there was another part of your question, though. It was also, do I think that it's a problem?
Oh, yeah. I'd be curious to know if you do think that's a problem.
I think it is a problem. I don't know that it's the same problem now. I'm talking about 1970-something, and things have changed quite a bit. But it is a problem that not so much intellectual pursuits are frowned upon. I don't know that they really were frowned upon. I think what was frowned upon was people engaging in things that seem to make them alien from the community that they're trying to participate in. It seemed less about knowledge and more about whose side are you on? And for me, that was a real problem.
Hmm. That's so interesting, Lewis. And you live with this family legacy that carries with it a lot of gravitas. You were literally the first child born to this new nation of Biafra. And if things had gone a different way, you probably would have been royalty or at least part of a first family. And yet you managed to write your book without dwelling on the loss. So I'm curious, do you feel loss for what could have been? Or was this something that you felt intuitively you needed to keep at bay in the writing of the memoir?
Well, in my own life, one of the many reasons that living in Nigeria is difficult for me is because I'm constantly reminded of that loss and what could have been, constantly reminded of, okay, you're not your father. You should have been more like him or that sort of thing. Or, you should go into politics and, capitalize on your legacy and things like that. That happens to me less now than it did when I was younger, but the book is a book about someone who's aware from a very early age that he is going to fail all of these expectations. He's going to fail these expectations because he is essentially and problematically an American now. Hmm. And he can send money and participate in memories, but he can't be the thing that's expected of the family. But for me, that's connected to most of the migrants in my family. As I write about them, they've been through coups and genocide and immigration and anti-colonial revolution and resistance and, all of these powerful epic things I began to read about in college. They'd been through it, but now they were semi-alcoholic cab drivers and ran dry cleaners on Slauson in LA. And so that narrative of epic expectations and failure for me seems to not just be something I'm writing about in terms of my own life. It's the story of a generation that all migrated after genocide or after decolonization and ended up in LA.
Wow. Yeah, that just exactly goes back to the word I used, epic. I mean, there's so much to unpack in this book. And, you know, my final question for you is about yet another theme that we haven't mentioned yet, and that's about men and male influence and your seeking to find male role models all the while being surrounded by women.
Yes.
And I have this strong sense that your book will be so important to men. And yet it feels like the type of book, just in part because it's memoir, in part because of the way that it's packaged, that it will probably draw in more women readers. And I'm curious if when you were writing, did you have an audience in mind, you know, whether male or female, white or black? And what do you hope will be the biggest takeaway from the book, regardless of who it reaches?
You might have to remind me of the separate parts of that question in a bit.
Well, my point is that I wonder if it will reach as many men as it will women.
Well, let me say a few things about the gender dynamics in the book.
Yeah.
I was very aware of it, hence the emphasis on aunties, aunties, aunties. Where are the uncles? Oh, there's an uncle over there. I need an uncle, that kind of thing. And then, of course, when I moved to Los Angeles, it's a world of men, but that world of men is largely the gang culture and the tough guy culture. I was very conscious of telling a story about how young men think that they need men. And I'm not going to say that they don't need men in some ways, but the idea that the lack in their lives growing up is specifically a lack based on the absence of men, that fantasy is what I wanted to identify as a problem, because you're surrounded by women who are doing more than enough for you.
Right.
And so, but because the narrative that we're all told is about, well, you need a man, the man is missing, you know, we miss out on and take advantage of or take for granted that world that's been created for us by largely women. And I really hope that it comes across to men when they read this book that, oh, wow. the desire for a the notion that what we're missing is a male figure is actually a problematic one, specifically because we're surrounded by all kinds of women taking care of all of those different roles and positions in your life. I really do hope that this book is read by everyone. I don't have a specific audience in mind. I know that I'm aware of immigrants to America who are thinking about new ways of being American, different kinds of ethnic positions in America. I want them to read it. I want Black Americans to read the book and understand that within Blackness, there are different nations and cultures and perspectives and, you know, responses. And racism actually doesn't suture us into one group. No, we're quite diverse in many ways, politically, ideologically, and there's a lot of resentments there. I want white Americans, I want Europeans to pay attention to the fact that there's a European aspect to our migration, my family bopping through the UK and then to the United States. I think I want Americans of all sorts to read this book because in the family of many immigrants, you literally have the experiences of a whole planet. And the thing about America is that it's not just a nation that houses and appeals to everyone. It's a nation that is deeply invested in multiple nations and histories and cultures and traumas and reasons for people's appearance on our shores. You know, America is not just a place where people end up. America is the reason people come here in the first place.
That's perfect. You captured exactly what I was hoping, which is what you want readers to get. And it's a beautiful way to end. And I really hope our listeners will get this book. So thank you, Lewis.
Yeah, thank you, Lewis. That was really inspiring.
Wow. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate your interest.
We will be right back with today's book talk.
Thanks, Grant. I chose The Tender Bar because you brought it up, and it is an interesting, fabulous book about male influence, which we are touching upon in today's interview. I loved The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer, and it really struck me that we don't have enough books of men exploring their relationships with men, or in this case specifically, the absence of men. And he is just amazing with his characterization. It's a book about being a New Yorker, about traveling, about a very, very special relationship with his mother. It's kind of a famous memoir, one of those ones that everybody should read at some point in time. And I also think it's a particularly good counterpoint to Lewis's book because they come from such vastly different worlds. And yet, as we've been talking about today, this universality of experience, there's some commonalities between the two books that are kind of undeniable. So I hope that you will check it out. If you've already read it, you know how great it is. The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer.
Thanks, Brooke. And there is definitely a universality of experience to being a writer. That's why we're here to talk about that. We are a weekly podcast, so you can download Right Minded on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. So thank you so much for listening. If you can leave us a rating or a review, we really appreciate it. So we'll see you next week. Thank you.